So today is the appearance day of Lord Varaha. So instead of our normal, we're reading in the eighth canto, but instead of our normal reading, we're going to speak directly about Lord Varaha, about his appearance, and also about his battle with the demon Hiranyaksha. And so today we'll start with a prayer that's offered by the devotees headed by Mother Earth, who reside in the northern part of Jambudweep, where they constantly worship Lord Varaha. So please repeat after me. Pramatyataityang prativarnam ridhe. Pramatyataityang prativarnam ridhe. Yo mang rasaya jagadati sukaraha. Yo mang rasaya jagadati sukaraha. Kritva kratang shre niragadu tanvataha. Kritva kratang shre niragadu tanvataha. Kridan nivepah pranatasmitang vibhumiti. Kridan nivebhak pranatasmitang vibhumiti. Pramatya, after killing. Daityang, the demon. Prativaranam, most formidable opponent. Mridhe, in the fight. Yaha, he who. Mam, me, the earth. Rasayaha, fallen to the bottom of the universe. Jagat, in this material world. Adi Sukaraha, the original form of a boar. Kritva, keeping it. Agradangshre, on the end of the tusk. Niragat, came out of the water. Udanvataha, from the Garbhadak ocean. Kridan, playing. Iva, like. Ibhaha, elephant. Pranata asmi, I bow down. Tam, to him. Vibhum, the Supreme Lord. Iti, thus. My Lord, as the original boar within this universe, you fought and killed the great demon Hiranyaksha. Then you lifted me, the earth, from the Garbhadak ocean on the end of your tusk, exactly as a sporting elephant plucks a lotus flower from the water. I bow down before you. Please repeat. My Lord, as the original boar within this universe, you fought and killed the great demon Hiranyaksha. Then you lifted me, the earth, from the Garbhadaka ocean on the end of your tusk, exactly as a sporting elephant plucks a lotus flower from the water. I bow down before you. So this verse is a nice prayer, but it doesn't have any purport. I promise you that later on when I talk about the combat between the demon, I'll read a verse with a purport that inspired me. So, before we start, Mangalacharanam. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Miritang Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitang Yena Bhutare Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Dadati Supadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavangscha Shri Rupang Sagrajatam Sahagana Randutangrutangscha Sadvetam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitangscha Hey Krishna, Karuna Sindho, Dina Bandho, Jagatpate, Gopesha Gopika Kanta, Radha Kanta Namostute, Tapta Kanchana Gorangi, Radhe Brindavaneshwari, Rishabhanu Sute Devi, Pranamami Hari Priye, Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha, Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo, Vaishnavebhyo Namon Maha. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Jaya Srila Prabhupada. So, this Lord Vraha Avatara is one of the 10 very prominent Leela avatars that are glorified in the song by Jayadev Goswami that we heard Srila Prabhupada give class about yesterday. And of course there are innumerable avatars. In the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in chapter 3 there's a list of some 28 or something, and then there's a verse that goes on to say that there are as many as rivulets of water coming down, unlimited avatars of the Lord. He appears in this world in Purusha avatars. He appears throughout the creation. He pervades everything as the super soul. And then he also comes in different Leela avatars. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya chaduskritam dharma sangsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. He comes age after age to reestablish the principles of religion, to kill the demons, and to protect the devotees and show love for his devotees. Srila Prabhupada emphasized that Krishna's completely, he has agents, he's competent to just send agents who could kill all the demons. He doesn't have to come personally to do that. But he comes personally himself, especially to show how he protects and loves his devotees. The devotees are always being harassed by various demons. In the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes how there's a demoniac nature. There are certain people who are born with divine nature, certain beings who have divine nature. They naturally want to be obedient to the Lord, follow the scriptural injunctions, do as they're supposed to do, and worship and glorify the Supreme Lord. And there are others who by nature are very proud, conceited, harsh, angry. They are atheists. They decry the existence of the Lord. They come up with various arguments to promote atheism and whimsical activity so that they themselves can compete with the Lord as the enjoyer of sacrifices and enjoyer of sense gratification. And so these those demons are perpetually being sent into the hellish regions by the Lord. And he comes and he smashes them. In Srimad Bhagavatam, and I was looking for the verse, I can't find it, somewhere in Maitreya Muni's teachings, I believe, he says that in Satya Yuga, the demons and the demigods, they live on different planets. And in the Treta Yuga, they live on the same planet, but in different countries, or dynasties. And that in the Dwapara Yuga, they live within the same families. Even like we saw in the Mahabharata, there was a war within one dynasty. And in the Kali Yuga, they live within the same individuals. And we have our own godly nature and demonic nature that may be competing with one another. So demons are always coming in different ways, and then Krishna is competent to come and protect us from these demons, and we're always thankful for his protection and praying for him to protect us from demons. So the appearance of Lord Vraha is described in chapter 13 of the third canto. And there, it's, as Hanumat Preshak Swami was saying a couple days ago, how it's described how Lord Brahma was given the duty to populate the universe with various generations of men, demigods, animals, and first, he had his sons, the four Kumaras, and they weren't willing to follow his injunction to procreate. You know, it's actually an important injunction or sacrifice for human beings that they should have children, they should study the Vedas, they should worship the demigods. These things are important. Daksha later was arguing with Narada Muni. He said, you're telling my sons to just become pure Paramahansa devotees and not have children, but it's required that you have to satisfy the ancestors, you have to satisfy the rishis, you have to satisfy the demigods through the performance of yajna, through study of the Vedas and so forth. But Narada Muni knew a higher principle, that those who are fully dedicated to the Lord don't have to do those things. They're automatically satisfying all those obligations, just as watering the root of the tree fulfills and nourishes all the branches and the leaves. So the four Kumaras didn't have to do that. They didn't have to procreate. But then when the Lord created when Lord Brahma created Swayambhuva Manu and Sadarupa, Swayambhuva Manu was an obedient son, and he prayed for instructions, and that he would follow Lord Brahma's instructions to procreate children and perform sacrifice as required for the maintenance of the universe. And the Acharya's comment that there's a Shweta Lord Vraha, a white-colored Lord Vraha, and that he appeared in this day of Brahma, he appeared in the first Manvantara, Swayambhuva Manvantara. And then in the sixth Manvantara, the Chakshush Manvantara, or the red Lord Vraha appeared. We're in the first day of the second half of Lord Brahma's lifetime. And this millennium is called the Vraha millennium, because Lord Vraha appears in this day of Brahma. And there's like 30 different days that are given in the Maitreya's descriptions. There's 30 days of Brahma given with their different names. And then he has 12 such months in his year, 360 days in his year. And then he lives for 100 years. And his nighttime also is equivalent. Sahasra Yuga Paryanta Maharyad Brahmano Vidu. So this is very inconceivable amounts of time. So our Acharya's comment that the descriptions in chapter 13 of Srimad Bhagavatam are amalgam of these two Vraha appearances, the red one and the white one. Vishwanath Chakrabarti and Jiva Goswami confirm that, Srila Prabhupada says in the purports. So when Manu was thus taking the orders of Lord Brahma on his head, he prayed to Lord Brahma to then give him his place and for him and his progeny to live and perform sacrifice. And then he prayed specifically for Lord Brahma to make some arrangement to recover the earth from where it had fallen into the waters of the Garbhodaka ocean at the time of devastation. This was the first Manu of this day of Brahma. So after each day of Brahma, there's a big devastation, and the waters, the earth is submerged underneath the Garbhodaka waters. So while Lord Brahma was thinking how to raise the earth from the water, and Srila Prabhupada comments that a devotee is sometimes perplexed in his service, but he's never discouraged. So Lord Brahma was thinking how, without being discouraged, he was thinking how to raise the earth from the water. And then from his nostril, a small boar the size of a tip of a thumb, the top part, portion of a thumb, appeared. A fantastic, magnificent, very beautiful, effulgent boar. Normally we think of a boar as a kind of a not-so-beautiful creature. But this boar is the most beautiful because he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he flew up in the sky and assumed a gigantic form with big lotus eyes and his body as hard as mountains, capable of lifting the earth from the bottom of the ocean. The Lord takes various forms, multifarious forms, according to the wishes of his devotees to worship him in a certain way, and also according to the mission that he's going to perform. Just like Lord Nrisimhadev, we heard the other day, came in half man, half lion, because Hiranyakashipu had prayed that he would not be killed by a a man or a beast or any creature. So he came in this remarkable man-lion form. And Lord Varaha came in a form suitable to take the earth out of the water. A boar with his tusks is accustomed to digging in dirty places and bringing things up. So Lord Varaha, the Supreme Lord, the original cause of all causes, appeared in such a form just to rescue the earth. And therefore the earth, here we see Mother Earth, she's praying like this with her devotees that she's associated with Lord Varaha. It's said that when Lord Varaha picked her up on his tusk, she looked very beautiful being associated with his beautiful tusk, and he also was beautiful, ornamented with the earth. And why don't we sing so we can all wake up this, just quickly, the verse from the Dashavatar Stotram. Vasati Shikara, no, how does it go? Vasati Dharana Shikare Dharani Tavadlagna. Vasati Dasana Shikare Dharani Tavadlagna. Say it again. Vasati. What's the second word? Dasana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Shashani, like the moon. Shashani Kalanka Kalevani Magna Keshavadvita Sukararupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare. Let's sing it again. After me. Vasati Dasana Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Vasati Sanna Shikare Dharani Tavalagna Shashani Kalanka Kalevani Magna Shashani Kalanka Kalevani Magna Keshavadvita Sukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare Keshavadvita Sukara Rupa Jaya Jagadisha Hare. So the translation here says that, O Keshava, O Lord of the universe, O Lord Hari, who have assumed the form of a boar, all glories to you. The earth, which had become immersed in the Garbhadaka ocean at the bottom of the universe, sits fixed upon the tip of your tusk, like a spot upon the moon. So the moon has these like scars or pockmarks on it, and the earth appeared like that on the tusk of the boar. So he was so big that the earth was just like a spot on his tusk, maybe. But very beautiful. So it's glorified this way. So I wanted to get to the actual battle. So when he was picking up the earth, when Lord Varaha was picking up the earth from below the water, the demon, Hiranyaksha, he had already conquered all the demigods. Demons can become so powerful. Today we have little demons, you know, but some demons are very, very powerful. And like Lord Krishna says, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka, anyway, he says that the world is Dukalayam Ashashvatam, from the topmost planet to the lowest planet. There are places of where repeated birth and death take place, and they're Anityam Asukam Lokam. And so even the demigods are harassed by demons. And in this case, these two sons of Diti, they had been Jaya and Vijaya in their previous life, but Hiranyaka and Hiranyakashipu, they were so powerful that they harassed all the demigods, and the demigods were frightened. Lord Indra and all the demigods went into hiding, and Hiranyaksha just wanted to fight with somebody. I enjoyed Hanumet Preshak Swami's description that when they come every time as Ravana and Kumbhakarna and Shishupal and Dantavakra, you can see their personalities, that one of them is very sort of like a very intense demon that's thinking out plans, and the other one is just a big oaf who wants to come and smash, you know, people. And Hiranyaksha was the big smashing oaf that came in, and he dove into the water. Sometimes he's described as having a serpentine quality to him. And he dove underneath the water, and he found Varuna, the king of the aquatics, and he challenged him to a fight, and Varuna said, well, I'm too old, I've given up my fighting now, I've retired from fighting, but Vishnu will come and he will kill you. You try to fight with Vishnu, just see what will happen to you, you know. So this angered him, and he went out and sought a battle with Lord Vishnu, who at that time was rescuing the ocean. And I wanted to read one verse and purport that just inspired me. That so he came out and he saw the Lord started insulting him. And the Lord went to protect the earth by floating her on the water some distance away before fighting. And he started challenging, why are you running away? You're like a coward. Why are you running away like a coward? And he started criticizing him in different ways. And our acharyas describe how these criticisms are really... Sridhar Swami, the original commentator on Srimad Bhagavatam, described how these are really glorifications, that he was trying to insult him, but he couldn't help but say the real truth about the Lord. Like he said things like, you live in the forest and you're a hunter and these different things. And there's descriptions. I'm not going to go into the details. But the verse that I wanted to read is Canto 3, Chapter 18, Verse 6. And I'll just read the English and the purport. Although the Lord was pained by the shaft-like abusive words of the demon, he bore the pain. But seeing that the earth on the ends of his tusks was frightened, he rose out of the water just as an elephant emerges with its female companion when assailed by an alligator. And the purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada says, the Mayavadi philosopher cannot understand that the Lord has feelings. The Lord is satisfied if someone offers Him a nice prayer, and similarly, if someone decries His existence or calls Him by ill names, God is dissatisfied. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is decried by the Mayavadi philosophers, who are almost demons. They say that God has no head, no form, no existence, no legs, hands, or other bodily limbs. In other words, they say that he is dead or lame. All these misconceptions of the Supreme Lord are a source of dissatisfaction to him. He is never pleased with such atheistic descriptions. In this case, although the Lord felt sorrow from the piercing words of the demon, he delivered the earth for the satisfaction of the demigods who are ever his devotees. The conclusion is that God is as sentient as we are. He is satisfied by our prayers and dissatisfied by our harsh words against him. In order to give protection to his devotee, he is always ready to tolerate insulting words from the atheists. Jai Lord Vraha. So, when he was being insulted like this, and the Lord put the earth aside, then he turned and he had his own chivalrous words back to the demon. This made the demon angry. Let me see where I am here. So Hiranyakashipu hissed like an angry cobra, and Hiranyaksha. Did I say Hiranyakashipu? I'm sorry, Hiranyaksha. And he struck with his mace very hard at Lord Vraha, but Lord Vraha was able to deflect the mace without difficulty. And that made him angry. Actually, he deflected the mace, but I think he was... later he gets struck anyway, but he became very angry at the demon and he took a big blow at Hiranyaksha's head and he hit him on the crown, but Hiranyaksha was able to manipulate his mace to deflect it, and he was only like slightly wounded and he wasn't really incapacitated. And so they began this fierce fighting with their maces together, and they were each landing blows on each side, and they were both bleeding, and they were becoming, by the smell of the blood, they were becoming angry at one another. And it's described in Srimad Bhagavatam that they were like two bulls fighting for the sake of a cow. The Mother Earth was sitting nearby as like a cow, and they were fighting. Then, while this fight was going on, Lord Brahma appeared. Lord Brahma and the demigods were watching and showering flowers on Lord Vraha. And Lord Brahma then came to Lord Vraha in fear, and he prayed, "Don't play with him anymore. You know, he's dangerous. The time is coming when demons get stronger in the nighttime. And you better kill him now without delay." And Vraha, he accepted the prayer, and he went to strike Hiranyaksha very hard. But Hiranyaksha knocked his mace out of his hand, and the mace went whirling down and blazing. It was miraculous to look at and very astonishing, looking splendid. And when he was disarmed like this, Hiranyaksha was chivalrous. He obeyed the rules of single combat, and he didn't strike an unarmed opponent. And so Vraha respected that. At least he had that much. But then Lord Vraha took out his Sudarshan disc. He invoked his disc. And then Hiranyaksha became very angry. And he took his mace and he hurled it with great force. And he said, "You are slain!" And he thought this would be the final blow. And then Lord Vraha just nonchalantly knocked it away with his forefront hoof, and like it was very easily knocked away. And this, and then Vraha was, it was his turn to be chivalrous, and he said, "Pick up your mace and try again, you know, have another go at it, you know." But he was completely confident, and this was angering Hiranyaksha more and more. And Hiranyaksha, then he picked up his mace again, and he threw it very hard again, and this time Vraha just caught it. He just stood there without moving and caught it as easily as Garuda catches a serpent. So then, he said, "Again, try again," you know, sort of taunting the demon. And the demon was humiliated and discouraged by what had happened before. He didn't want to try with his mace again, so he got a big trident, a big, huge, powerful trident out, and he threw the trident very hard. And then just Vraha just chopped it to pieces with his Sudarshan disc. And then the demon became angry, and he came very hard. He struck him very hard in his chest. He struck Lord Vraha in his chest with his fist, and then he disappeared. But Lord Vraha had said he was not disturbed at all by the blow. Just like if you strike an elephant with a flower garland, it won't make any difference to the elephant. So then, when he disappeared, he started using the old tricks that the demons have, these yakshas. They have mystic powers, and the sky became very dark, because he couldn't defeat him just in a physical combat, so he had to use his mystical tricks. And the wind started blowing very hard, and dust and hail started flying around, and big stones were flying as if they were being shot by machine guns. And there were rain from the sky came raining hair and stool and urine and blood and pus and bones. And there were naked demonesses coming with tridents, with their hair loose. And the mountains even started discharging various weapons. And big armies of rakshasas and yakshas started marching, some of them in cavalry on horseback and some of them on foot. And they were uttering these cruel slogans and savage slogans. And then Lord Vraha just dispersed it all with his Sudarshan disc and cut them to pieces. And at that time, Hiranyaksha's mother, Diti, remembered how her husband, Kashyapa, had told. Remember that Diti, she induced Kashyapa to conceive a child at the wrong time, even though he warned her. But she forced him to. And then He told her that the result of that would be that she would give birth to these demons, and they would harass all the demigods and harass the universe, and then they would be cut to pieces by Lord Vishnu. And she remembered that, and she saw here was Vishnu ready to kill her son, and her from her breast, instead of milk, blood started flowing out of her fear that her son was about to be slain. And so then Hiranyaksha wasn't finished, even though his yaksha tricks didn't work. He tried to crush Vraha by embracing him in his arms, giving him a big bear hug. But when he tried to put his arms around Lord Vraha, Lord Vraha wasn't there. He was outside of his arms. So then he was bewildered. Lord Vraha had superior mystic power to his. And he turned around and he started striking Lord Vraha with his fists very hard. But then Lord Vraha just nonchalantly slapped him with his foot and at the root of the ear. And he started wheeling, and his eyes started bulging out of their sockets, and then his hair was disarrayed, and he fell down like a giant tree cut down by the wind with his arms and legs broken. And it's said by the Acharyas, there's another verse in the second canto where it said that he was pierced by the tusk of Lord Vraha. And our Acharyas have commented that after killing him with his hoof, then he also pierced him with his tusk. And then Lord Brahma came to the scene and saw that the body of the demon still had this luster and glow about it and looked like he had had a very glorious death. And Lord Brahma offered some prayers in which he said that the yogis, they meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord or the hoofs of Lord Vraha, and they aspire after seeing the lotus feet in meditation. But this demon was so fortunate he got to be touched directly and killed by the lotus hoof of Lord Vraha. So, the Lord Vraha is specifically mentioned as the Lord and enjoyer of all sacrifices. Like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Aham hi sarva yajnanam bhokta cha prapureva cha. So Lord Vraha appeared out of the nose of Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma appeared at the same time in creation as the Vedas themselves. And his breathing is the Vedas. And Lord Vraha is non-different from the personified Vedas. He is his body is made out of all the yajnas and all the his pure goodness. He's completely transcendental, and he was Lord Manu, the first human being, Swayambhuva Manu, the king of all the human beings, was praying how to get a place and an opportunity to carry out the instructions of Lord Brahma to perform sacrifices. And he needed the earth to be raised out of the ocean, and Lord Vraha came there. And Lord Vraha is especially associated with sacrifices. And in the prayers of the Mother Earth, with the devotees in Jambudvip, they start with a prayer that Srila Prabhupada describes as an Upanishad mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Mantra Tattva Lingaya Yajna Kratave Maha Dvara Vayavaya Maha Purushaya Namah Karma Shuklaya Tri Yugaya Namaste. O Lord, we offer our respectful obeisances unto you as the gigantic person. Simply by chanting mantras, we shall be able to understand you fully. You are Yajna, sacrifice, and you are Kratu, ritual. Therefore, all the ritualistic ceremonies of sacrifice are part of your transcendental body, and you are the only enjoyer of all sacrifices. Your form is composed of transcendental goodness. You are known as Tri Yuga because in Kali Yuga you appeared as a concealed incarnation, and because you always fully possess the three pairs of opulences. So this reference to Tri Yuga was also explained by Prahlad Maharaj, who was praying to Lord Nrisimhadev and pacifying him with his prayers. And he uttered this famous prayer, Ittang Nritirya Rishideva Jashavatarayar Lokan vibhava yasi hangsi jagat pratipan dharmang mahapurushapasi yugan nuvrittang chanakkalo yad apavas triyugota sattvam. In this way, my Lord, you appear in various incarnations as a human being, an animal, a great saint, a demigod, a fish, or a tortoise, thus maintaining the entire creation in different planetary systems and killing the demoniac principles. According to the age, O my Lord, you protect the principles of religion. In the age of Kali, however, you do not assert yourself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and therefore you are known as Tri-Yuga, or the Lord who appears in the three yugas. So the Lord Vraha is the Lord of sacrifice, and in this age in particular, the sacrifice is recommended is the Sankirtan Yajna. And the Lord appears here as Lord Chaitanya. He doesn't assert himself as the personality of Godhead. He appears as his own devotee. And thus he sets an example for us all how to become a devotee. He experiences what the mellows of being his own devotee, as described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So he's called a Channa Avatara, a covered avatara, this Lord Chaitanya. And he's come now, and we're all participating in this movement, and he's glorifying the different avatars who come and explaining the science of Krishna consciousness, the science of God. And Srila Prabhupada has given it to us as our duty. I saw the other day in Srila Prabhupada's quarters, I saw the cover of the original Srimad Bhagavatam that he brought over from India, the first three volumes of the first canto. And on the cover it said, India's sublime contribution to culture, philosophy, politics, sociology, religion, and love. And I was thinking that it's his duty to all, his mission that he's given all of his disciples is to spread this Sankirtan movement all over the world and to establish this Srimad Bhagavatam and this science of Krishna consciousness, establish it as a fact, not just one of many different faiths that different people have as religion. You know, may have different flavors of religion and stuff, but to actually establish Lord Chaitanya's science of Krishna consciousness, and particularly that this hearing and chanting, just like we're doing now, you know, there are so many different practices for spiritual advancement, and some people partake to pranayama and physical exercises, but this discussing Srimad Bhagavatam and repeating what we've heard from Srimad Bhagavatam is Sankirtan Yajna, as well as going out on the streets and chanting or distributing Srimad Bhagavatams and inducing people to read them. So I'll take some time for questions now. Hare Krishna. Oh, Maharaj. And then Panchagoda.
Swami's first.
Swami's first. That's the etiquette.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.
How would I suggest that could be done? Well, it's not the work of one devotee. I'm sure the Prabhupada could have done it all himself, but he gave us this task for many devotees with different talents and different abilities. He established Bhaktivedanta Institute, speaking of science, where devotees who are familiar with and are colleagues of other scientists who have PhDs in science can also teach Srimad Bhagavatam in a way to make the scientists understand. It shouldn't be seen as some ancient mythology of some... There was a book written by Stephen Hawking, or ghost written by... He had some ghostwriter help him with it or something. It was called The Theory of Everything, I believe. It came out a few years ago, and it was a bestseller. And in the later chapters, it was about, you know, the issues that were... confronting the modern scientists in the search for the theory of everything, in the search for one, because there are, you know, theories of relativity and quantum mechanics and thermodynamics, different scientific theories work well within their own sphere, but they can't get them to work in other spheres. And they're looking for one unified theory. But the first few chapters were absolutely horrible. Sri Dayananda Maharaj told me, he said, that's what happens when someone steps out of their own field of expertise. You know, that he's a scientist, he's a mathematical, you know, physicist, cosmologist. He doesn't know anything about anthropology and culture. And he started, what he was saying was basically that the whole history of all humankind, of all cultures and all civilizations was trying to do science, but they just weren't very good at it, and therefore they had religion. And then, sometime 400 years ago or something, the Europeans started having being rational and systematic, and they developed science. So, I mean, that's a joke. It's laughable to anyone who has any feeling for culture at all, but that's what this book was saying, and it was a bestseller, unfortunately. There are demonic principles at work in our civilization, and Krishna has come to protect us from them. So I would just say that it's not the work of any one person, and it also may seem impossible, but like we were saying before, devotees may be perplexed in their duty, in their service, but they're not discouraged, because they know that Lord Krishna can do anything. Dhruva Maharaj, he worshipped the Lord. He wanted something that was impossible. He wanted a kingdom that was greater than that of his great-grandfather, greater than that of Lord Brahma. But Lord Brahma's kingdom is the whole universe, so how could you have a kingdom greater than the universe? But by Krishna's, by worshipping Krishna, Krishna can do the impossible. Or rather, we can't conceive of Krishna's potencies. They're inconceivable, and no one can think. Even Lord Brahma prays to Krishna after the Brahma Vimohana Lila. He says, some people may think that they understand you, they know something about you, but as for me, and he's the most intelligent person of all, he says, but as for me, I can't understand you at all. I'm an insignificant, and my greatest fortune would just become a follower of the Brajbasis. How do we go about doing it? We have to pray for Krishna's mercy, and we have to use our intelligence, use all of our talents, whatever we have. Those who are good at making money can contribute money. Those who are good at speaking and attracting people, those who are good. And people, I noticed that devotees attract their own kind of people too. When we were all hippies, we were attracting all the hippies to become devotees. The scientists will attract the scientists, the businessmen will attract the businessmen. Panchagoda Prabhu, please.
So Shraddha, faith is a very important aspect of spiritual development. And of course, you know, any God-believing person can understand that God can do anything and everything. But when you hear stories like a demon throwing the earth planet to the ocean, and then the Lord comes aboard, and they're having a big fight on the ocean, and the earth is sitting on the side there, it's a little stretch of the imagination and or the test of faith. So many people, scientists, are in the circles, they give up Christianity because of not believing in the story. It's all mythology. It's all stories made up because they didn't have a scientific approach. So how do we strengthen this shred of this faith? And do we just like dismiss the doubts that may arise? And how is this possible?
Well, of course, faith is required. And when we hear from authorities, our natural tendency is to believe what we hear from authorities. And as Panchagoda was pointing out, in Western Europe, the Christian authorities had, the bureaucracy of the Christian church had become very cumbersome and corrupt in a way that people would make money out of getting an office for a church just because their father was somebody and he got, a little kid became a bishop somewhere and he had some, you know. And then there was a big upheaval, as there was also economic differences, and the northern part of Europe was becoming wealthier now, and there was, but the southern part of Europe was where in Italy was where the Pope was, and there became a huge fight within authorities, and then I don't think it's a coincidence that it was during these wars that started in the 16th century. Actually, it started while Lord Chaitanya was on the planet, that Martin Luther nailed his theses to the Wittenberg Cathedral, his 99 arguments against what was going on in the church at the time, in 1515, I believe. So Lord Chaitanya was still present on the earth and maybe had an influence in these things. But somehow or another, during that time was when people really started renewing this. I mean, I'm not saying there weren't scientists before, you know. I'm trying to remember there was someone in Padua before Galileo, way back in the 1300s and stuff, that were doing these kind of experiments. But I think that by the 17th century, while these wars were still going on, Descartes had fought in these wars, and these philosophers started to develop this theory of science where the mood was, let's not believe anything that anybody says. Let's only believe what we can perceive and see and measure and keep track of. And this system developed. But there are still problems, like I said, that the scientists, in fact, they glorify the fact that they don't pretend to know everything. They glorify themselves, although I think it's kind of cheating that everybody has a little ego involved. But they say, well, if once we're proven wrong, we're willing to revise our theories. And this shows we're honest, we're not pretending, we're not hypocrites. And that's true that hypocrisy is rampant in the age of Kali, and even among religious institutions and like the churches and things like that. And people can smell hypocrisy and they don't like hypocrisy. And so scientists can say, well, at least we're being honest and we're saying what we can see with our blunt material senses. They've given up there was this philosopher named Alfred North Whitehead who worked in mathematics and so forth, and he wrote that all Western philosophy was a history of footnotes to Plato. So they used to say that Plato and Aristotle, they were like two different sides. And there's a painting in the Sistine Chapel where Raphael is depicting the academy of in Greece, or Plato had an academy and then Aristotle had a Lyceum, two different schools of philosophy. But Plato was pointing up to the sky, and his philosophy was that we have to purify our senses, and to become real philosophers, we have to be able to perceive something otherworldly, something higher. We have to remember what the knowledge that we have lost that used to be, that once upon a time we belonged in a kind of spiritual world, and somehow or another, he gave an allegory of a cave that we're chained in just looking at the reflections on the wall of the cave, and we have to come out into the light and see the real world. And he said, at first the light is so dazzling we won't be able to see anything but bright light, and then we'll be able to see the forms that were making the shapes. The Aristotelians looked more at the world and were more interested in the natural world and trying to establish categories of things in the world. And then the modern scientists from the 17th century started overthrowing Aristotle, which before that, Rabindra Swarup wrote a really good article involving Star Trek, among other things. But he wrote this article about how there was a sense, Europeans would walk around their cities and see these buildings that had been built by the Roman Empire. Things like in Rome, there's the Pantheon, and there's these different buildings with big domes and things that they couldn't build, and big aqueducts and things. And they always respected that the ancient people had knowledge, and they were receiving knowledge from the people, from the Greeks and Romans, and also the Arabs had knowledge from Aristotle and so forth. And then in the 18th century, it was what Rabindra Swarup says is known among historians as the Enlightenment consensus. And this was the idea that now our modern science was better than anything the ancients had, and that there was a certain arrogance about it. But I think, to answer your question, Panchakota, I believe that devotee scientists will actually show how the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's not just a collection of stories and myths, like it may appear like that to people who are uninitiated, but to people who go deep into it, they understand the deeper meanings, and there's a real description of what is matter, how it's organized, how the world is created for the purpose of the conditioned souls who want to try to exploit nature, and how it's based on false ego, and how all of the elements come out of false ego, all the senses, the working senses, the knowledge-acquiring senses, the gross elements, the subtle elements, and how they all interact. And there's many different descriptions. In fact, they're not all exactly the same. They're kind of in different angles, and they give you kind of a three-dimensional, as you learn them all and study them. And this presentation by Srimad Bhagavatam can actually present solutions that philosophers, the modern philosophers, are struggling with in science. And I believe that when they start to perceive the Srimad Bhagavatam as being such a sophisticated scripture with a sophisticated but different philosophy, just like there was a Newtonian philosophy that reigned for many years about space and time, and then in the 20th century, both the theory of relativity and the Einstein's theories, general and special relativity, and then as far as very small things were concerned, the theories of quantum mechanics and Planck and Ehrenfest and Bohr and Pauling, they overthrew this previous paradigm and said that time and space are different than we thought they were, and the universe isn't even determinate, and it's not deterministic, and it's not even determinate. The quantum theorists were saying you don't even know where a particular particle is. So maybe I'm getting too complicated, but what I'm saying is I think that devotee scientists will actually present things from Srimad Bhagavatam that will show how time and space and matter should be conceived of as different, and it's consciousness-centered. And, you know, the material world is created for the conditioned souls, and because their consciousness has become impure, then there's been this creation of the gross elements and so forth for them to try to exploit. And also, it's also created to give them a chance to be liberated. And so the Lord comes and he pervades everything and he appears in different avatars. Pavayatyesha satvena lokanvai lokabhavanaha lilavatara nurato devatirya naradishu. In both men, demigods, and animals, he appears in all the forms and all the species of life to come. And he's come as Lord Chaitanya for those who are sumedhasaha. So it's not just, you know, some people think, Srila Prabhupada said, in the verse that says that in the second chapter, Bhakti Yoga, Bhagavati, what is it? Verse 7, 2, 7. Vasudeve Bhagavati, Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha, Janayat Yashu Vairagyam, Gyanang Chayadahaitukam. And Srila Prabhupada is saying that actually these high-class qualities like jnana and vairagya, they come automatically to the bhaktas, to those who have real devotional service. Srila Prabhupada says that many people think that bhakti is this easy path for those who aren't sufficiently qualified with jnana and vairagya to do the more difficult speculation, jnana and mystic yoga practices, meditate for a long time and stuff. But he says it's both simple and sublime. It's simple for the beginners and it's sublime for those who are really very advanced. And so it's not just a religion for the, you know, women and shudras and people who aren't really great thinkers, but actually great thinkers can actually enjoy this Sankirtan movement also, and they will, and they do. Many of our devotees, we have so many brilliant devotees, more and more PhD scientist devotees are joining every day, and realization is that they should, you know, support each other and help each other and get along in trying to fulfill Srila Prabhupada's mission. This is a challenge for all of us. We have to be harmonious, you know, as we subdue our own false egos and stuff, and we should learn to appreciate other devotees and support them in their devotional service and listen also. And try not to just be like, if we devotees quarrel, that's the way we can defeat ourselves. Because when devotees are quarreling, Lord Chaitanya leaves, Lord Krishna leaves that place. But when devotees are nicely talking about him with faith, an assembly of people who have bhakti, then he is always appearing there. In fact, there's a verse that says that he doesn't appear in Vaikuntha, he doesn't appear in the hearts of the yogis, he doesn't appear in these different places. But where he appears is where the devotees are hearing and chanting about him. Anything else? We have Mahendra Prabhu. Give him a microphone. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada says that the scientists, they have this theory that, well, there was a chunk. And then the chunk exploded, or they call it a singularity or whatever. There was just matter all in one place packed together, and then it just exploded, and then everything happened. And the atheistic Sankhya philosophers also have, the atheistic Kapila philosophy also has that thing that the laws of nature are doing everything without Krishna's involvement. But Krishna says, Maya adhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetunani nukonteya jagadviparibartate. That Krishna's supervising everything. He's also in connection with Vraha, I recall to say, that he's the seed-giving father. In the 14.4, it's an important verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, Tasang Brahma Mahadyonir Aham Bija Pradakpita, that nature or the earth is like the mother of everyone, and then Krishna is there to give, without the touch of the Supreme Lord, or without the touch of spirit, and he's the Supreme Spirit that's behind all spirits, then matter is inert and it won't do anything and it won't be able to move. And the three modes of nature is in a stable condition, and they don't do anything, and then the Lord comes and he agitates it and makes everything happen, and he enters into it as the Purusha avatars and enables us to perceive things and try to enjoy through our material coverings. And then as devotees we can become liberated from that and actually perceive his internal energy, which is always there and it's never destroyed. Whereas this material creation he sometimes creates, and then sometimes it's destroyed. So yeah, it makes a lot more sense, as Mahendra is saying. It doesn't, to say that everything just comes from nothing and then life is just about trying to enjoy the illusion. You know, I read one book about consciousness. They have this series of books now called A Very Brief Introduction to Blank, you know, A Very Brief Introduction to the Roman Empire or to Existentialism or to whatever you want. And this one was A Very Brief Introduction to Consciousness by Susan Blackmore. And her conclusion was that from what we now know, you know, she's influenced by behaviorists like Daniel Dennett and so forth, and her conclusion was, we're not really conscious at all. We're just machines made of chemicals, and consciousness is kind of an illusion. This is what the demons say, right? The world is just, you know, life is but a dream, merrily, merrily, merrily. Yeah, we also say it's kind of a dream, but it's real, but you're dreaming that you're the enjoyer, when factually Krishna's the enjoyer, he's the controller. So you have to get out of that dream and wake up. But she's saying, you know, yeah, it's just a dream, but we can get used to thinking of it that way and go on with our lives and realize that we're not conscious. So it doesn't make it, to follow the conclusions of materialism and atheism to their conclusions really doesn't make any sense at all. But they say once bitten, twice shy. It is Kali Yuga. Religious leaders, brahmanas and so forth, have sometimes been hypocritical and sometimes not qualified. My wife is giving me the high sign here that I should stop talking, but that's her duty. So what we have to do is through purity. Purity is the force. Through this Krishna consciousness, we have to revive the pure. We have to make real Brahmins who are not hypocrites, who are not just trying to exploit, who are not trying to use the birthright to take advantage of people. People in positions of authority actually have an obligation to use what's given to them, their talents, in service to Krishna and in service to the people in general. And when we do that, and people will see that purity, and this Srimad Bhagavatam will become established as an irrevocable fact in the world's culture. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Lord Vraha ki. All glories to the devotees. Hare Krishna.